31st, 1974.
Yes, sir. Son of the, in this whole period since 1940, what do you see as the major change that there's been in Southern politics?
Well, I think the biggest change has been the elimination of the civil rights question as a political issue.
If somebody had come to you 20 years ago and predicted that Senator Stennis would be introducing a black congressman from Georgia at a prayer breakfast in Washington, what would you have said at that time?
Well, I don't know. I don't... I think that would... I would not have been shocked by a thing like that.
You could have foreseen that day coming, even then?
No, I think there's always been considerable latitude, say, in the field of religion. Now, they wouldn't, whites and blacks would not have attended church together generally, but I can, 20 years ago, not too far away from there, I can recall blacks, not in large number, but a few, attending the church that I attended in Huntsville. Not in numbers, but I remember definitely one couple that used to come, and they were well received. I doubt if it was as far back as 20. Well, I don't know. You know, time gets away from me.
I went to the prayer breakfast this morning, and I was sort of struck by that, yeah, thing in terms of the book. But 20 years ago, first of all, the idea of there being a black congressman from Georgia. And
I'm sorry I couldn't make that breakfast. I've made that breakfast practically every year since it started. But I simply have had to clip a bit of the things I used to make. I have our committee is one of unusually heavy, has an unusually heavy burden. And every morning, this is one exception, but I didn't know it was coming, I have to be in committee at 10 o'clock, presiding over the committee, so I find that I just have to leave off lots of things, and I did not try to make it this morning.
How does the removal of the race question affect the way Southern members of Congress campaign or operate when they get here?
Oh, I think that's where the greatest change has been. Of course, I was here when we had those terrific civil rights fights and filibusters and so forth and so on. That has been eliminated. And as far as voting is concerned, we've always had a very good Negro vote in Alabama. Not as numerous as it should have been, but there's no question but what later legislation, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and other legislation, those things have changed the voting in Alabama, and I'm sure that's true all over the South.
Now, that was one issue that united Southern congressmen. Are there any other issues in the course of that 25 years that unite Southern congressmen like that one did? As a Southern group?
Let me say this. I've pointed this out quite often, and this doesn't apply to this 25-year period necessarily completely, and probably not as relevant to it as it was back in the days of FDR. I used to be rather amused at the term conservative or ultra-conservative label that was attached to every Southern congressman. And I used to point out the fact that it's true Southern congressmen were conservative on such questions as race matters and things of that kind, but that on economic matters, they were liberal, exceedingly liberal. And I pointed out that practically every economic measure during FDR's years was not only supported by Southerners, but most of them were put through by Southern members of Congress. You take old Bob Doughton at the of North Carolina. He's the man that wrote Social Security into the law as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. You take Walter George of Georgia. He was chairman of the Finance Committee. And you go back to I'll instead of trying to name them, I'll just mention that so I've always said that the Southerners were liberal in economic matters. And I think it grew out of the fact that we were more or less a colony under great restrictions, economic restrictions during a lot of that period of time. We had a terrific time getting, had a terrible time, very hard time, ever getting railroad rates, freight rates adjusted. As you know, the South was a territory of its own, and the, what was the other part of the country known as? The but anyhow, the whole Northeast, clear across to Chicago, the West was not entirely free. It had its high freight rates too. But we fought over that thing for years here in Congress. And finally we got the freight rate discrimination removed. It took years of fighting to do it.
When did they finally remove it?
1940. The act that removed it, the act that opened it up, was passed in 1940. The Commerce Act. Let's see, I used to know the number of that bill. I believe it was 2009. I'm not sure. Senator Hill is the one that wrote the provision into the bill and into the law, directing the Interstate Commerce Commission to make a study of freight rate differentials throughout the country. Now, as it happened, Alabama had two members on the Interstate Commerce Commission at that time, one of whom had served with TVA and had made this study for the TVA on freight rate differentials. But anyhow, the Federal, Interstate Commerce Commission made that study, and they came out with a very fine report saying that it was unfair and it ought to be removed, and then action was taken removing it. So that today you have uniform freight rates. I probably should not say uniform, but at least you haven't got those discriminatory rates. Cotton would be grown in the South, shipped to New England, made into cloth there, that would be sent back to the South under the disadvantageous freight rates, and had to be sold at a higher price than that same cloth that went to the Chicago area. They always refer to the Chicago area because that is the central trade area of the United States. Well, when we got freight rates changed, the cotton mills closed in New England. And the cotton mills in the South developed. I don't mean developed originally, because of course we had cotton mills all the way back. First cotton mill in Alabama was just outside my hometown, called I can't think of the name of the mill now. Run by water wheel. And this is opened in 1830, I think it was. A Bell factory, that's what it was. When I was a boy, we used to my mother used to make my shirts, and she made them, we lived out in the country, she made them out of Bell factory cloth, and that was named for that old mill. But those mills moved south. You don't find cotton mills. I don't know whether you have any cotton mills up in New England now. Not, I'm sure you have wool mills, but not cotton mills, I don't believe. And it changed the whole thing. It had a tremendous impact on our economy. I have often thought of that as being the one thing that liberated the South economically.
Exactly how did Pittsburgh Plus work?
You had Pittsburgh Plus
work. That was the same big thing.
They were building a post office in my town at the time I came, just during the first year or two of my being in Congress. One day I was down there. I walked over where they were putting up that post office, and here was a steel lying on the ground. I said, where'd the steel come from, Birmingham? Oh, no, this came from Pittsburgh. You could actually get steel delivered there for that post office cheaper from Pittsburgh than you could from Birmingham, 100 miles away. And that had that had a great effect, too.
With this removal of civil rights as an issue, and the point you made that Southern members of Congress always were liberal on economic issues, do you see the next group or the newest group of congressmen coming out of the South being basically liberal? Or at least not conservative?
I think Southern members of Congress are, I don't think it's quite right to think of them as being ultra-conservative. There are a few. But I believe most of the congressmen in the South are, I would call them liberals. As a matter of fact, I've often said this when people ask me if I'm a conservative or a liberal. I said, I don't like labels. I think the thing that a person ought to do, and I think this is characteristic of the typical Southern congressman. Issue comes up, he weighs it as to whether or not he thinks it's right or wrong. And his decision on that, I think, is something that has a great effect upon that decision, would be his measuring it for its benefit to his constituency, as well as to the country as a whole. I think you've got to take both into consideration. Now, I'm just thinking of my own congressman from Alabama. We've got one congressman who I think probably would be considered liberal. I mean, if you were going to put labels on him. That happens to be my own congressman. He succeeded me when I came to the Senate. And, it's Bob Jones in the Tennessee Valley. By the way, I've often thought that the very fact that we have the TVA running all through the Tennessee Valley and all through this district has had a lot to do in influencing the vote of the congressman from that district. I think it is true when I was a congressman of the district. I think it's true with Bob Jones. Now, if anybody in our state was labeled liberal, it would be Bob Jones. Now, the adjoining district is held by Tom Bevel. I think Tom is what you might call a middle-of-the-roader. There are some in our state that certainly would be called conservative. Some of them may be ultra-conservative. We've got three Republican congressmen. Edwards of Mobile. Dickinson of Montgomery. Well entrenched. They were elected in 1964 and they've held over. Two others were elected in, but they just served one term each. But these three have stayed on and are, as I say, well entrenched. I think probably they would call themselves conservatives. Although Buchanan often votes not just the way the American, what do they call it, American Constitutional Association, would like him to vote. And the same thing is true to a lesser extent with Jack Edwards of Mobile. However, they were, all three of those were given recognition by the ACA this year, I noticed. And I like to think of Southern members as weighing issues very carefully and voting for them as they think they would benefit their constituency as well as the nation as a whole. Now, label conservative or liberal, as you may, I just don't like the labels.
In the 1964 election in Alabama, you pointed out five Republican congressmen were elected, and next time only three, and there have been three since, and there have been no really major large numbers of Republicans elected to the legislature. You have managed to...
No, there are only two Republicans in the legislature.
You've gotten more than 60% of the vote, I think, in the your last two elections against Republicans. Do you think Republican movement is crested in Alabama, or is it still growing?
Well, of course, I'm a Democrat. I'd like to say that it crested, but I don't know that I could say that very well. I think Alabama will remain essentially a Democratic state, but the Republicans are working, I think, harder than they used to. For years, they just went along as a matter of form. We used to say they didn't want a big strength in Alabama. They liked the power in the hands of a few. But they're getting away from that. They are holding a statewide primary. I saw just the other day that the committee had met and had decided to have a statewide primary this year. It'll be the second one. They held one 2 years ago, I guess it was. But it didn't amount to very much. I understand this year they're really going to try to push out local candidates. And that... If they will do that, if they'll be a party and work at it and run candidates, in the past they have usually run a candidate against the senator and against maybe one or two of the Democratic congressmen. Of course, the three congressmen have run, and few local people like those two members of the legislature. One of them, by the way, is from my hometown. Very fine young fellow. The other one is from Mobile. Rather strange, two ends of the state would have the only two Republican members in it, in the legislature. I think if they would hold their statewide primaries, put out local candidates, even if they do get beat, at least that's a way to develop strength. And I think they can do it, and I'm quite sure there is an element in the Republican Party that would like to see that done.
Is the influence of the South in the Congress on the wane? Used to be that you couldn't do anything without the Southern congressmen because of the chairmanships of the committee and seniority and so on. You think that is waning or going downhill somewhat?
Well, I don't know. Now, you mentioned chairmanships. Of course, you know chairmanships are nearly always, almost without exception, achieved through seniority on the committees. The South does have the habit, more or less, of keeping its members in Congress. They become, I think there's no question about it, that increasing seniority gives the congressman more power. And the way things are now, a Southern congressman who gets on a committee can pretty well look forward to becoming chairman of that committee. It takes a long time. It took me 19 years in the Senate to become chairman of the committee. In the House, when I was there, I had worked up to second from the chairmanship on a very powerful committee. It was the Military Affairs Committee, which at that time, it's been merged and now with the Naval Affairs Committee and is the Armed Services Committee. And that was brought about purely by staying here. And I, as I see it, that that power will continue.
Even if you elect more Republican congressmen and senators?
Yes. Oh, unless you... Well, Republican senators and congressmen... Oh, you mean from the South?
From the South, yeah.
Of course, if you dilute them, that dilutes the power that much. But the only way a Republican congressman could climb the ladder and become chairman would be for Republicans to retain control of Congress over a long period of time. And that has not happened since... Woodrow Wilson had a Democratic Congress each time, didn't he? And, well, since FDR, let me go back to this. Since 1930, Congress went Democratic, as I recall, in 1930. You remember whether that's right or not? I think that's right. And since that time, we've had only two Republican Congresses. Now let me check on that. We had one in 19 and elected in 1946, served 2 years. In 1952, Eisenhower brought in a Republican Congress for 2 years. Those are the only two periods. I think I'm correct in that, since 1930. Well, now you don't get that power unless you keep them here. And a Republican doesn't have the full power unless he stays. Unless Congress is Republican. Of course, a person can go to the can be ranking minority, and that's a very powerful position. You take Wallace Bennett on the Finance Committee, John Tower on the on my committee, George Aiken on the Foreign Relations Committee, and just go over all of the Milton Young on the I think he's the ranking Republican. He's ranking Republican on the Appropriations Committee, and you can just go around the various committees, and you'll find that the ranking Republican member, ranking minority member, has been here a long time and has become ranking member. And that's a, I'd say that is next to the chairmanship so far as power within the committee is concerned. So that's just what they've got to do in order to build up their power. And to lessen the power of the Southerners, so far as position on committee and so far as chairmanship.
You think they're going to stay that powerful in the future, about the members of the Congress and the South?
I believe so. We will probably have a slow increase. House. Now let's see. We have two Republican members from Tennessee. We have one from North Carolina. One from Florida. That's all, isn't it?
One from South Carolina.
Oh, sure. Don't forget Strom. He used to be a Democrat, you know.
Virginia. Yeah. Did you say Virginia?
Scott.
Oh, yeah. Scott from Virginia. Well, most people down my way think Virginia's being the North anyhow, but it's not. It's part of the South. That's true. And I think there will be a greater increase in House members than in senators. I don't know how many Republicans. Well, we named them just then. What would that be? No, we were naming the senators, weren't we?
I think every Southern state has at least one.
Every Southern state at least one. Well, I would not be at all surprised over the years to see an increase come as the Republican Party builds itself up in its respective state. And I do feel that the Republican Party, so far as I have had contact with it, as far as my state is concerned, I'll limit to that, has not been actually building itself up over the years. They take spurts, but they take a spurt when they're running with Goldwater or when they're running with Eisenhower or somebody like that.
How do you evaluate the Republican Party in the South in terms of philosophy of government and what that's going to mean in terms of dealing with the problems in the South?
I don't know much about the actions of the Republican parties in states other than my own.
Well, your colleagues in Congress, so from the Republican members.
Well, let me say, I believe, without just considering each one individually, I believe they pretty well represent the sentiment of their people. I've had times I've kidded John Tower. You know, when John Tower ran in, is he running this year? Well, his last race, I kidded him being elected by the liberals of Texas. I think it was largely true. Of course, John Tower's far from a liberal, but he does, he's a good man to work with. I work with him on housing. He's the ranking member. I work with him on all matters in the banking committee, but he is particularly good. Well, he's good in all of his work, and he doesn't necessarily, he does when the administration takes a strong stand on something. Ordinarily, he goes along with the administration in the committee. Just generally, where we're running without pressure being exerted by the administration, John is pretty much middle of the road. And I think he's representing his people.
As you think back over all the campaigns you've been through, have there been any major changes in the way you campaign in Alabama, say, in the last 20, 25 years?
Well, of course, there have been changes. The first time I ran, television wasn't out. We had no, that is in a congressional district. We had no television in our district, and if I remember correctly, it was just beginning to show its head. That was 1936. You remember whether we had television then or not?
You had more radio.
Oh, yeah. We had one radio station in the seven counties. We had one radio station. And I made some speeches over that radio station. 15 minutes for $25. Try to do that now. And so campaigning had to be more personal. I still campaign that way. I try to get as much personal contact as I can. I always say the best campaigning is the personal campaigning, when you shake hands with a person and look him in the eye and tell him, answer his questions, tell him what you think. Naturally, that has changed largely because today we do use television, we do use radio. My first campaign cost me, I don't know, I would say, around $2,500, maybe $3,000, campaigning over seven counties. Today, and I had strong opposition. I'm not talking about in the general election. I had no opponent in the general. I'm talking about in the primary. I suppose if a person had the kind of opposition I had in that primary down there today, he'd have to spend $100,000, maybe more. Fortunately, that is the only really hard campaign I ever had. Our congressman retired. I had supported him in his races and I'd been out in some of the other counties campaigning for him. So I had established myself enough to make me dare to run. And there were five of us to start with. And then that was down to two. There was a man from the west end of the district, and I lived in the east end of the district. We ran it off. I beat him by 898 votes. That's the only time I've ever been in a runoff. Every time since that, I have won in the first primary. When I had opposition, as a matter of fact, to me, this is interesting. I don't know whether it'll be to you or not. It has nothing to do with the politics in the last 25 years. But when I first was elected to Congress, I had no idea of making a career of it. In fact, I thought I probably wouldn't be here but that first term. I could just see myself being ousted at the end of that first term. But at the end of that term, I had no opposition. Same thing second term, third term, fourth term, fifth term. So I ran six times. Now, when I ran the sixth time, a Republican qualified against me in a general election. Of course, it wouldn't have amounted to anything. But after I'd been nominated for a sixth term, our senior senator, Bankhead, died. And a special election was called for that, special primary. I got into that primary, there were five of us, and I won without a runoff, I'm glad to say. Now, as soon as I was nominated, the chairman of the Democratic Committee who lived down at Mobile called me and he said, young fella, don't you take your name off that House ballot because that Republican is qualified, and if you take your name off the ballot, he will be elected by default. And if you let a Republican be elected in that district up there, you need never run again for office in Alabama. So I left my name on the House ballot, and as a consequence, I was elected to both the House and the Senate in the same election. That's the only time it has ever happened. I've got, see the top of the left, those two certificates? One of them is a certificate of my election to the House on November 5th, 1946, and the other is a certificate of election to the Senate on November 5th, 1946.
Did you claim both seats when you got here?
I clung to the House seat until my certificate was up here for the Senate, and then I resigned.
Had that ever happened before in the country?
No.
I didn't know that.
In fact, a lot of people raised the question. That Republican down there tried to get a contest. Joe Martin told him he had no ground for any contest at all. And I had mail from other states saying, I read that you were elected to both houses. I contend that under the Constitution that can't be done. And Wright asked me about it. I did. It did happen. By the way, just...
What is the constitutional...
It says nothing about it.
No, the House, each House is the judge of the...
Of its own membership.
Right.
That's right.
So if they judge that you were fit to serve in both, you could have.
No, you can't do that. No, I think... No, you couldn't serve in both simultaneously. It may be that I was serving in both simultaneously because under the rules of the Senate, a senator who is elected to fill a place, a vacant place, becomes a member of the Senate the day following election. Well, now, I stayed a member of the House and drew my House pay. Now, wait a minute, did I? Yeah.
Well, you must have been a
member
of both.
I drew I drew my pay until the 16th day of November. That's the day that I resigned from the House. And yet, when I put in that resignation, I automatically became a member of the Senate on November 6th. I was a member of both houses during that time. But that's just a problem. Some of the newspaper people found out about it at the time of the election. So I remember one of them asked me this question, said, suppose the House needs you to organize it, Democratic. What would you do? I just facetiously answered and said, I'd stay there to help organize the House. I said, well, suppose the Senate needed you too. I said, I'd get some of my friends to filibuster over there until I could finish with the House, and then I'd run over there. Of course, all of that was chit-chat.
So now you,
I'm sorry I got off on all of that.
No, it's very interesting. But the you talked about civil rights being no longer an issue as the major change. And I don't know if you know Neil Pierce in Washington, but he has just written a book on the Deep South states, in which he even goes so far as to suggest that that Judge Frank Johnson has been a more potent political force insofar as change, political change in Alabama is concerned, and Governor Wallace during this period. And I just wondered how you.
Well, I don't care to contrast. There's Frank Johnson is a personal friend of mine. I recommended to him first for district attorney, and then when vacancy occurred, I recommended him for the judgeship down there. He's a personal friend. And Frank Johnson has had a very great effect on our law. By the way, there's another one down there, too, who was a member of the circuit court, Reeves, Dick Reeves, R-I-V-E-S. I don't know if you know him. He's retired now, although he's still, you know, under the court system. He can still be used, and he works pretty well all the time. We've got another young fellow from Alabama, John Godbold, who is active on the court down there. He was he never had any other judgeship, but he's a person of very liberal views. Another good friend of mine, Lister and I, Mr. Hill and I, recommended him to the court. Frank Johnson has had a great effect. And I want to say this about Frank Johnson. The things that the decisions that he has made have not necessarily, should not be construed always as being probably his personal views if he were a citizen. See? Frank Johnson is a very, he's a man of integrity, and he construes the law as the law is made by courts above him. And he's fearless in putting that law into effect, and he has thereby been a great influence. I don't think it's in question.
What do you think is the meaning in Alabama terms of Governor Wallace's recent symbolic acts in crowning the homecoming queen and addressing the Black Mayor's Conference? What does that mean?
It's been most interesting. I tell you, it's really hard to believe after some of the things that he has done and expressed years before. I started to say that in one of his inaugural addresses, he said, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. But I believe that was John Patterson, right? You know. But
I think Governor Wallace said something very similar.
Well, maybe he said that. Maybe he's the one that said it. I believe John Patterson closed his inaugural address with those words, but I'm not sure. We all know what his views have been. I personally believe that he has changed in his thinking. I think he's come to realize that the blacks in Alabama have come to a position of power and recognition. And of course, his big stand was standing in the schoolhouse door, don't you remember, at the University of Alabama, to prevent Lucy, what was her name, from being
Lucy.
Admitted. And that was his big stand. He went over and spoke to the black mayors at Tuskegee recently. They were holding some kind of a meeting. It was sponsored by the black mayors. You know, we've got, I don't know how many black mayors, three of our big cities, I believe. Let's see, Tuskegee and Mobile. Pritchard and... seems to me there's one more. Good-sized cities. By the way, we've sent mayors to other parts of the country. Let's see, who is this Alabama mayor that in one of the northern cities? And there's one from Georgia up in, is it Newark, New Jersey, or Jersey City?
It's
up there in New Jersey.
Yeah, Newark is the place.
Newark, yeah. So... they've been pushing out. Got a Negro congressman from Georgia, and a very intelligent, very able congressman. So I think it's something that has developed as time has passed, and I believe it's had its effect on him. Now, I have no way of knowing that. I've never heard him say one way or the other, but he's done a good many things that make it appear that he doesn't think the same way he used to think. What was it St. Paul said? When I was a child, I spake of it as a child, thought as a child, and something else as a child, but when I became mature, I changed to a man and so forth. So maybe there's been a change in his thinking.
Now, we've heard two different thoughts expressed by different people. One, that he can read the voting returns, and two, that the effect of his unfortunate experience has made him a more compassionate person. I just wonder if you had any insight into this.
Not at all, except just my own observations. And every person that's in public office watches the vote, you know that. I don't think there's any escape from that. So I'm sure he has watched it. But I think the second one is certainly true with it.
Do you think he may actively campaign for the National Democratic ticket in 1976 if he's not on it?
It's entirely possible. Oh, wait a minute. Campaign for what?
For the National Democratic ticket.
Well, I don't know. You just can't safely predict what his action will be. I would say that as of this moment, his thinking is one of cooperating with the National Democratic Party. By the way, I'm going down to Birmingham tomorrow. We have a big Jefferson-Jackson Day dinner there tomorrow. Now we have it every year. Robert Byrd is to be the speaker. Governor Wallace will be there. It's usually a tremendous meeting. On Saturday, the State Democratic Executive Committee meets in its, this is the year that they reconstitute the committee. And I read from the papers, and I think this is correct, that he and the chairman of the State Democratic Executive Committee are working hand in glove.
This is Vance?
Yeah, Bob Vance.
Is Bob Vance really putting the party back together?
Yes, in very fine shape. He's done a remarkable job. What if he's kin to your North Carolina Vances way back? I never thought of that.
I'm
Are you connected with the school?
Oh, we're
you intend to make politics a career, but obviously you've done it now. Do you think you're going to stay in office and keep on running?
No. I hope to stay here till I complete this term, but I think I could very well leave it at that time.
As you look back, you have any regrets now that you made that decision?
Not one bit. I always had a kind of a free-thinking idea regarding it. I have never actually been tried in the fires of opposition, except in my first race.
In either the primary or the general election?
Yeah.
Except the first time.
I've had opposition, but ordinarily I've never been forced into a runoff in the primary.